It's been 50 years since NPR went on the air, and in those early days, there were four women who shaped what we heard. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Many have listened to their voices over the years, but back in those days, women reporting the news was a rarity. Lisa Napoli has attempted to capture those heady days in her new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. We have her on this morning on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with what seemed like almost a fifth character, which was where women were at the time that these women were coming of age. As I mentioned a moment ago, not a lot of women reporting news. Give me a sense of what that period was like.
Yeah, that's what makes the story even more interesting, because it really is a wider story of women's inability to get jobs in any aspect of many professions, but particularly in journalism. If you got a job at a newspaper as a woman back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, earlier, of course, you couldn't get a job doing anything serious. It was all women's news. And basically, of course, women had a very difficult time getting credits, bank accounts, besides getting professional jobs, education. So it was interesting to read that these four women, who we know so well, whose names we know so well, we didn't know that they had struggled the same way so many other women of their generation had.
It seems as if they were sort of caught in this sort of feminist wave that began to flourish. Certainly in the 1960s, we had certainly Betty Friedan with the feminine mystique coming along, that women were going to reevaluate who they were.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that these women weren't activists. You know, we think about Ms. America, the TV series, or if anybody, you know, listening was around for this period of time in American history, you think of protests and pickets and bra burning and all of that. But these women were doing that, but they were doing that without the activism. So they were doing it quietly in their own ways and rebelling against the system that had repressed them for so long.
So let's turn to Susan Stamberg. Give us a sense about her background. Because she did actually was in radio before she did NPR.
She was, but what's interesting is that it was accidental. Of course, now today people make careers in radio, want careers in radio coming out of school. They go for special training. But Susan had gone on scholarship to a women's college, Barnard, in New York, right up the street from where she'd grown up. And no one in her family had gone to college. And so it was a big deal that she was able to get that kind of entree to the world, if you will. And then she married a Harvard-educated lawyer, newly minted, and really basically accidentally got a job in educational radio. Before we called it public radio, all these little stations around the country licensed to schools were part of the educational radio, not even network. They were just individuals. And basically, Susan was dying to get out of her crummy job as a typist because she was, you know, it was a dead-end job. It was a good job in terms of pay. She took a pay cut to go work in radio, but she wanted to do something more. And it would have been fine if all she wanted was to be in that secretarial role, but she really wanted a bigger platform, and she was able to get it by taking a pay cut and going to work at this little educational station, WAMU, which, of course, now is a powerhouse in the radio system.
So describe for me her character. What was she like?
Yeah, she was naturally wired to be a conversationalist on the radio, not an announcer, so to speak, but she was just wired to have this ongoing cocktail party salon that is what All Things Considered, the show she was elevated to co-host in 1972, was. And she really defined the sound of public radio, this conversational approach and the idea that, you know, I may not be an expert in fill in the blank, but I'm going to bring my lens to whatever or whomever I'm talking about. And she just did that naturally and so well. And when they elevated her to be the co-host, she'd started as a production assistant at NPR, at All Things Considered, when it first launched. There were people who pushed back because they weren't used to hearing women talk, anybody talking like that on the radio, but women in particular. It was very unusual. And so that was a strange departure for radio at the time. And of course, it's become the hallmark of public radio, is people having conversations like this one.
And then, of course, there's Linda Wertheimer. Describe a little bit about her and her Carlsbad roots.
what I loved about her story is that it's completely different and yet very similar to Susan's, in that she went to school. She was raised, born and raised in Carlsbad, New Mexico. She was the daughter of grocers, hardworking people in the town, and she was, from the get-go, a scholarship student, a scholarly student. She was winning awards. She was just a great student, which is something that women weren't expected to be. And then when it came time to go to college again, got a scholarship that allowed her to go to a fancy women's private school, Wellesley, as opposed to going in-state, which would have been a good education, but sort of elevated her to a different world and a different ambition. She was from the generation, as was Susan, where they didn't grow up with television. And Linda talks about how she saw Pauline Frederick, an early female correspondent on TV as a young woman, and how that sort of reset her ambition from wanting to be the secretary to Edward R. Murrow when she grew up to being a correspondent herself. But like Susan, she bucked up against all kinds of discrimination when she started working. People said women shouldn't be behind the microphone, that they didn't have the authority in their voices to be behind the microphone.
Now, of course, she was eventually married Fred Wertheimer, and who headed up Common Cause. And so you had this sort of interesting situation, and we see this again later on, of someone who is involved with NPR and public radio, and yet has a spouse who's involved with politics and lobbying. How does that play out in terms of as her as a journalist, you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In we think of this inside the Beltway world that we see on television 24/7, or if you tweet, it's right there. Politics unfolds right before your eyes. But back in the 60s and 70s, it was a different world, and it was unusual for women to have jobs in power. That's not to say that there weren't occasionally women who did. So this whole idea of a power couple, two people who held jobs in D.C. that were, you know, on the fringe, or not even on the fringe, but were in the center of the storm of the action, that was an unusual thing at that point. Now, of course, it happens all the time. And so they were both very committed and to their respective works. But I think it was, at least in the very beginning, for Linda, just a delightful surprise that she had any work, because she'd had such a hard time getting the work that she wanted to do. And they, you know, I don't really mind the depth of how that relationship played out at NPR over the course of Linda's tenure there. I mean, she's still technically on the masthead of NPR after 50 years, but and her husband's retired. But it is interesting, this sort of inside the Beltway personality that they had. Susan was married to a civil servant herself. Her lawyer husband became a civil servant, and you know, I think that their worlds were pretty separate. But I don't really know what went on for them at home.
Right, right. And then we have, you know, Nina Totenberg, who seems like a real workhorse in many ways. You know, she's obviously famous for the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill business, but she was breaking stories all the time, and that's just one we have to be aware of.
Yes, before she went on to marry a senator, she's currently married to a surgeon. Her senator husband had passed away. Nina was a single woman in D.C., really blazing trails. It was so unusual for a woman to be, she was a print reporter at the time when she first arrived in D.C. She struggled to find work, and she was breaking stories and bucking up against this belief that she must be getting the stories by sleeping around, because how could a woman be breaking stories otherwise? But she was, she is, as you say, a workhorse. She was then, and she still is now that she's in her late 70s. And of course, she's completely defined how the legal world and the Supreme Court in particular are covered, especially in broadcasting. It was a kind of snooze of a subject, and she invented this way of, you know, talking about this incredibly important subject. So I just, it's been interesting to get to know her background, too. She came, her father was a violinist, a concert violinist, and she'd grown up in an excellent, a family with excellent origins, and just basically went to school and decided she didn't like school. And she just wanted to go out there and be a reporter. And she bucked up against all of that discrimination. It was incredible.
And it seems like an odd beat to have that as the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, lots of people do it. But she obviously didn't go to law school, that kind of thing. And yet
right.
She found herself doing this masterful job in terms of interpreting all these very complex issues.
That's what I love about this whole story, is that it's four people who really, it's alchemy. I mean, you can't predict when you're going to enter the workforce, right? We have no choice about when we're born. But these four women took a period in time when women were marginalized. And in Nina's case, she fell in love with a subject that people either study for years to practice or study for years to be able to interpret for other folks. And yet, it just really fell in her lap, this beat. You know, she was covering anything anybody would ask her to cover. But this was an area that she really loved. I mean, she met Ruth Bader Ginsburg when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a professor. And Nina just called her up because her name was on a legal brief that she was writing about. And she didn't really understand and she wanted to know more. So that's the kind of person she was, that she recognized that she needed to educate herself. And she had no fear about calling people up and asking them, hey, could you explain this to me? I'm not sure I get it. And, of course, now she's the person who does that for many of us. And I love that story. I love that story.
And, of course, then there is at least what I consider the star. That is Cokie Roberts, who obviously is married to, comes from a political family, but also became a star when it came to television. She had a presence on the air. Describe what her life was like, because she seemed to obviously have a kind of an inside look at American politics.
Well, that's also another great angle to all of this. She's the one who grew up with the most incredible access, with her, both of her parents ultimately serving in Congress. Yes. And so she went out and got educated, went to college, and all she wanted was to get married and have kids. And she did. She convinced her college boyfriend to marry her. And she ran around the world with him as he was a foreign correspondent. And then she decided, she had this awakening that she did want to work. And she bucked up against this problem of not being able to find work as a woman. And when she walked in the door at NPR, which was still a really kind of pipsqueak network in 1978 when she did, she really didn't want to cover the stuff that she had grown up enmeshed in, D.C., politics. She wanted to do something different and carve something out for her. And to Linda Wertheimer's credit, Linda Wertheimer, who had studied the subject so closely so that she could understand it and cover it, didn't throw Cokie under the bus. The two of them joined forces and together became this force at NPR of two women talking about politics and how it impacts people across the United States. They tag-teamed their coverage of Congress, coverage of the presidency, of presidential campaigns, and went on the trails and really forged a lifelong friendship as well. And as you mentioned, Cokie transcended all of that because the TV networks were looking to put a woman who could speak intelligently about this stuff on the air for the first time regularly. And they auditioned Cokie, and she was so dynamite. She had, you know, I think it was Sam Donaldson who said, you know, she was a total package. No, it was David Brinkley, the show she was on. And she was the total package. She was confident and smooth. She looked good. She sounded good. But she loved radio so much that she didn't want to give up her radio job. And so she kept it while she was able to start at ABC and become this ultimately superstar.
By the way, give us a sense about the history here of NPR, because it starts out with an afternoon program, as we all know, and then, of course, picked up in the morning as well with Morning Edition. Well, describe that evolution for us.
Well, that's what's also, it's so interesting and hard to talk about this. I hope people will read the book, because the story of how the women came into this system that was just beginning in the 70s was part of the outgrowth of the, the Educational Public Broadcasting Act, created in the late 60s to sort of make up a new sort of medium that didn't, you know, wasn't commercial like the rest of broadcasting was back when only three networks ran everything. And so the people who were charged with that task weren't really sure what they were going to do with radio, because radio at that point was marginalized. TV was a superstar. And they thought about it and played around with it, and this show that they started off in considered was their first experiment with it. And it was also a time, Don, when FM radio was not big. It wasn't in it wasn't capable to tune in on every car radio, which of course is where so many people listen to radio. And so as the system grew, as more of these small stations got professionalized and were able to join the larger system, the network grew, and so more and more people could hear All Things Considered. And it just kind of mushroomed over the course of 15 years. It didn't just come out of the gate. My last book was about the creation of CNN. When CNN started, it only was in a million homes. Nobody had cable then. And this is sort of the parallel thing 10 years earlier, where radio just was reemerging as a force, and certainly emerging as a news force. And these four women helped make it happen. Of course, there were many other people involved, but they embodied the sound of it, this unusual sound that now people listen to, obviously, with abandon.
Of course, no story would be complete without Frank Mankiewicz, who made NPR, but then almost sunk it. Describe a little bit about who he was, because he seems to be this bigger-than-life kind of character.
Yeah, you know, the third president of NPR was the son of Herman Mankiewicz, this storied writer in Hollywood, who'd come from radio, actually, before he went Hollywood. And Frank Mankiewicz's son didn't want to go Hollywood, but he had a lot of Hollywood in him. He understood that you had to make a splash and that you had to dazzle people. And so when he came into the system, the public radio system in 1978, he understood, he didn't really know what public radio was himself when he got hired. He'd come from politics, and he just wanted to do the best he could with this nascent place. And his idea was to make a splash, and to do that, of course, required spending money, which it turns out they didn't have, and so he nearly bankrupted the place. You can't really technically bankrupt a nonprofit, but he ran it financially into the ground, and that's sort of the drama here of the story, is how that all unfolded and how the women rose up to help save the network, of course. But it was very close. It was perilously close to folding, all because of this grand ambition that Frank had propagated.
Describe for me particularly the women's reaction when they suddenly discovered that this institution that they loved so well and worked for so long at could be on the brink. What was their sense about that happening, and their also sense about Mankiewicz himself?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. You've probably worked in many shops where one part of the shop doesn't know what the other shop is doing. It's true for many of us wherever we work. And so these people were plodding along and happy to have a champion and a cheerleader who was publicly known. He was a man about town. He was well regarded all over the place. And he was vying for them inside and out. And then to learn that the place that they loved so much and worked so hard to create, and worked for very little money to help create, of course, because the money was really terrible back then. They were all devastated that this had happened. It was a very dark, dark period in the system, for sure.
So how did they react in terms of trying to get this thing back on schedule?
The employees, you mean?
Yeah.
Many people got laid off because of the financial difficulties. The people who weren't laid off worked to raise money for it. It's probably too complicated to describe on the air, but there was all this murkiness about the relationship between the mothership of NPR and the individual member stations, and how the finances were entwined, but not the way people who listen probably think they are. And so this is a different moment in the system, and everybody just rose to rally to save the place. Like I say, though, those who weren't laid off, and many people were laid off at that time.
By the way, sort of jumping ahead, not in necessarily your book, but as you look at the media and so on, NPR, of course, is now in a much different place in terms of the media landscape than certainly it was in the early 70s. What sense do you get about where it is and the legacy of these women who made it?
Well, you know, now we think nothing about turning on the news and hearing a woman delivering it and having, you know, intelligent conversation about it. So it's hard if you don't imagine that that used to be the case, that that wasn't usually the case, that it seems nothing. Like, wow, okay, of course, it's the next generation of announcers or the next generation of programming. But what I wanted to do in writing this book was look at the people who made it possible for the people who are working today to do their jobs and for the system to have grown as much as it has. The entire media ecosystem is, I don't have to tell anybody listening, crazy. It's unnavigable. You could spend every moment of every day times a million listening to stuff and there wouldn't be enough time. And the idea that it developed from a place, the NPR developed from a place where it was an hour and a half a day that they struggled to get on the air, where now people grow up aspiring to work in the system, going to school expressly with that dream, ambition to get into that public radio system, is pretty remarkable in the course of 50 years. But that's what I love. I love origin stories. I wrote a book about the creation of the McDonald's empire, not because I'm a big McDonald's consumer, but because I think it's really important to understand where these places that rule our world, our airwaves, our everything, where they all came from. And this definitely is a humble origin story.
Do you think that the people realize that change, and particularly women, appreciate the fact that there was this groundbreaking that, you know, now there are a lot of things that are assumed that clearly were not way back when Linda and the rest of them were coming up? I mean, do you think there's an appreciation for that? Because I'm sure you wrote this book in part because you want that legacy to live on.
Absolutely. You know, I knew what I bumped up against going to work in the 80s. I'm in my late 50s, and so I came into a different world than these women did, and I knew it had been hard for the women before me. My mother had explained to me the financial issues that women faced, but, you know, I don't think you really believe it until someone lays it out for you, and that's what's one of my goals. Yes, the origin to transmit the origin story of NPR, but also to explain that women didn't always have the rights and the access that they have today. Absolutely. And thirdly, to look at these four women and sort of peer the curtain, behind the curtain, at what they went through to get where they are.
Finally, I want to return to Cokie Roberts, who passed away because of cancer. And you spend actually a good deal of time at the front of the book and certainly towards the end of talking about her passing. Tell me a little bit about how that was. And you describe, apparently, there's a photograph of all four of them. But she certainly was missed when she passed on, particularly with the other three.
Well, they had a unique relationship with each other till the very end. And, you know, they were not just colleagues. They were dear, dear friends who helped each other through all of life's trials and tribulations and joys. And so for them, the loss was, you know, deep. It says something that Cokie's family, probably directed by Cokie, knew that they should transmit her funeral service live on, I think it was on C-SPAN, it was definitely streamed on the web, because they knew how beloved Cokie was by so many people who read her books and watched her, listened to her all these years. But for these women, I mean, it was the passage of an incredible friend to them and marker of an amazing moment in time. None of them, when they walked through the door at NPR, could have imagined that they'd ride out the rest of their lives in this place. I mean, most of us don't ever think that when we go to work anywhere. But they certainly didn't, and it certainly didn't seem possible at certain, you know, difficult moments in the network's history. So for them, it was a deeply sad, deeply resonant and personal occasion that Cokie had passed away. And, you know, she seemed to have beaten cancer, and then it came back. I think, you know, obviously it was a shock to them, even though they were in on the fact that she was ill at the end of her life.
Do you think there will ever be a group of women like that again that pioneer this kind of thing? I mean, there's just so many people, and obviously the media is so diverse in many ways, and in some ways it's not. I mean, to have that kind of impact?
You know, it's hard to say. The idea that they had this collective impact at a place that was brand new, you know, there are really terrific people working now in all media. But yeah, that moment in time that we had will never come back. And what is replacing it or what is different, I can't say. Maybe in the realm of science, I don't know about. But yeah, I think it was a singular moment in time, and they were a singular force.
And if they did have something to say to women, what do you think it would be?
Oh, well, I've heard them say it. I've been privileged to do some events with them around this book, even though the book is unauthorized and, I sort of foisted myself on them. They've been very, very generous in saying that they think that women working today work incredibly hard, harder than they did, because they have to feed so many more media beats. You don't just work at NPR and do radio. You have to do web and tweet and all kinds of other things. So they admire women who are working today, and they definitely don't want women working today to lose sight of the stories that they experienced and the experiences that they had in getting where they were, for sure. And they also say, wisely, choose your battles. You know, get upset about things that really deserve to be upsetting, and don't just be angry. And of course, I think I myself would be loath to be prescriptive. I mean, I think in the book I tell their stories and what they experience, and hopefully those are items that people will take away who are starting to work or maybe mid-career in any profession that are applicable. And you know, ultimately, that being nice to everybody you run into if you can, and connecting everybody in the world is a potential source for a story, and you never know who you might meet, who will lead you to a next job, or yeah.
Now you're also going to make an appearance, I guess, at Browse About Books. So when is it supposed to be?
I've literally done dozens. I've got 3 interviews just this morning, so it's wonderful. I'm very excited about it, but I just literally take every day by day. Yes. Pardon me, it is the 7th, and it's 2:00 my time, so is it 5:00 your time? I'm so sorry.
Yes.
I just assumed that you had that there.
Right. No, that's fine. That's the case.
Okay.
So people
yeah.
be able to hear you, yes.
Yeah. Well, now they hear the whole story, so hopefully they'll go out and buy the book from Browse About hosting me. Yeah.
No, that right, exactly.
But yeah, it's been delightful how many people want to talk about this, but I'm having a hard time keeping up, and I'm the person who has to keep it all up.
Right.
So, like I say, I take it day by day. So
we've been speaking with Lisa Napoli. She has written a new book entitled Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Oh, I appreciate your interest. Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.